Welcome to QuakeCast, the podcast for id Software's classic Quake and the games it inspired.
Hello, Quakers. It's Dump Truck. This episode of the QuakeCast is just a little bit different this week because RC and Lady RC have welcomed in Junior RC to the world, and so they have their hands full right now. I'm sure we're going to hear all kinds of stories about bringing in new Quakers into the world when RC is back on the show. So I'm flying solo today. So my guest today is George Drusta. He's a Hungarian game developer based in Cologne, Germany, and an alumni of the Cologne Game Lab. He co-founded a company called Ludopium, and they're an indie game company with their first title, Vectronome. That's a rhythmic puzzle game about music geometry and flow. Vectronome is this colorful, vibrant game that has a unique feel to it. RC did play it on Watch GGRC on his YouTube channel a few months back, and we wanted to have George on the show because it's such an interesting game. He's also currently working on a level design course based around Trench Broom and Quake 1. So without further ado, here's George.
I basically got into playing Quake 3 multiplayer with my other game design colleague here at our company. We started to play duels because we were really eclectic, trying out different games, and we were both really into shooters, Team Fortress and such. I grew up on shooters, but I never played Quake. It wasn't just really my generation. So now I got into Quake Live, which is basically Quake 3, but different. And we started to play duels. We got a server. It was really cheap. And then I kind of got really nostalgic for playing, Team Fortress, Counter-Strike Source, all those games. And because I had experiences making levels for that, I kind of now, picked up Trench Broom a little bit and looked into that because it was amazing to me to have such a modern thing, because level design was always what I really enjoyed I usually made more levels. Like, I had more time in the Source SDK than with all my other games combined. And now it's Quake 1, but it feels a certain way. And I think I just really miss that tactile feel from the Quake games that I don't get in modern games. I think it's the only game I'm playing right now. I think I got into Quake very recently, which is kind of strange, probably.
And did you make maps for Quake 3, or that's how you started playing?
No, I just started playing, I didn't make, I didn't really like the new, I forgot the name of the editor software that everyone uses.
Radiant?
Radiant, probably, yes.
Yeah, Radiant.
Because it was so similar to Hammer, and I just couldn't get over it. It was, my muscle memories were different, and with, so I kind of gave up on that. We wanted to make 1v1 maps and test them on each other because we only need two people to test it. Mm-hmm. And that's what I really didn't like about doing Team Fortress maps, that I needed to write myself up for a schedule and wait for the community to test the maps on the server. And it was always very exposed because there were 20 people on your server and you have to test with 20 people. But for dual maps, you can test with your friends. And it still makes sense to play.
Yeah, that's actually really cool. I've never really made a map for Source Engine games. I know I definitely messed with Hammer and played around a little bit when Team Fortress, very first SDK for Team Fortress came out. But that's as far as I took it, and got busy again with life and everything. But it's funny, you know, Trench Broom does make it just so simple to jump in and make old school levels so quickly. So
I started the Trench Broom a week ago, and this is connecting to what I'm doing right now, because right now I got asked to teach level design. Well, not really level design, but an environments arts class for a master studies for a film school in Hungary. And they didn't have anyone who does games, and I did games. I knew the professor were looking for people, and they asked me, and I said yes. I'm completely out of my depth. But they asked me, so I did it, and I thought of, hey, let's make a class for them where because they have no idea about games. They are coming from a theater and film background. And I want to explain to them how to make environments, because they want to make environments for games with Trench Broom, because it's so simple and so minimalistic. And they can, okay, this is the aspect of level design that is separate than lighting, that is separate than texturing. And it's so broken down in Trench Broom that I want to use that as to show them what aspects there are to game design and level design.
That's very interesting, because, you know, it solves a lot of problems as someone's learning, and if some never have touched any kind of, you know, level design tools or CAD or what have you, it makes sense to use the easiest tool, because it's still powerful. You can still do magnificent things with Trench Broom, but for a student, for someone who's just coming into it, yeah, I think it's a really good tack. Also, you know, there's some tutorials online I'm sure you'll be relying on for your class.
I think I have a text tutorial that I found, a written one. I actually know, I have a friend in Australia who does a level design class, and he also uses Trench Broom. And he sent me some written tutorials that I think I will translate into Hungarian. And then... Nice. I also want those resources to be there in other languages, and that will probably be a little bit of a contribution to the community.
Well, I'll have to try to find a Hungarian translator for my tutorials.
Your tutorials, I remember I used to watch when I first started with Hammer. I watched Three Clicks Phillips tutorials. I don't know if you know him. He does Counter-Strike videos now.
I've probably seen the videos for sure, because I did a survey of all the different mapping tutorials before I started.
So, that's actually a good, interesting thing, because I think his tutorials were the best. He didn't have any sort of, with every tutorial, I hate this when this happens, they say, you want to, I don't know, curve tool, and sometimes you might want to make curves. Curves can be useful for this and this, and like, that's not important. I just want to know what to do. Like, they cut to the important stuff. And his videos were 30 seconds or something, very short, very condensed, one topic. And I feel really good about yours too, that there's not much, oh my God, I really don't care. And I start skipping or doing double speed. I never have to do that.
Yeah, it's disheartening to see the YouTube analytics on videos, because it's like almost no video is watched all the way through. I think people just kind of pick and choose what they want, but I don't take it personally, because I try to get rid of all the, I try to trim the fat, so to speak. And sometimes I'm more successful than others, but enough about me. So you have a really interesting story, and I'm really excited to have you on, because you have a perspective that's super unique. Obviously, you just got into Quake mapping for professional reasons, but you've been going to school. Why don't you tell us about your education that you just went through, and then you can lead into Vectronom.
Right. So I went to game design school. I really wanted to make games, and I really, really wanted to go to a university where they teach you how to make games, but I didn't want to go to a school where they teach you tools and hard skills that much, because I felt that I can do that on my own. I was doing that on my own. I was finding my tutorials. I was finding my resources, and kind of, I didn't want that from a university. I wanted to have to explore the topic and just discuss theoretical things about game design in general. And this school was amazing. I think this is, I got really, really lucky. I got into the first year of the Cologne Game Lab. So they just started their bachelor course as I came in. There were no other students, basically. There was some master students and us. And we were in a building, and they barely had any furniture. They just were basically building the course as we went along, which was kind of funny. It was a 50% project, 50% theory kind of situation. So we learned through projects. And every semester, we have a semester project. And I think for the first one, we did a little platformer called PolyGuys, which was two polygons. You're like basically platforming. It's side scroller. And you can, with a button, send vertices to the other character. And it's cooperative. So it's like nice. WASD and arrow keys. And as you get a vertice, you get bigger. And as you lose a vertex, you get smaller. So square, if you're square and you send a vertex to your friend, you become a triangle. And your weight changes, stuff like that. So there was a lot of pressure plates, tight spots. Also, you have to shoot the vertice that kind of describes a path between the two characters. And then you can aim the projectile, basically, by positioning yourself cooperatively. So that was our first game, and it was a lot of fun. And then we just started to make a lot of games. That's what I really love about the university, that, okay, this was a project, this was a whole world, and then you get to put it down and move on and do another one later on with different people and experience a completely different thing. Games are really strange because anything could be a game. We did a game which was set in a basement, in a real basement. We took an Arduino, connected light sensors. So I created these tiny light sensors with LEDs next to them. And you're in the dark room with a flashlight, and we kind of channel the flashlight cone to be a small circle. And you have to just, when a LED lights up, you have to shine light on the LED, which has the light sensor next to it, and then it kind of pops. And we have a big screen on the floor with a scoreboard and music. And it was like a digital game. So it was, we designed an analog game like a digital game, and that was really exciting.
That sounds really cool. I mean, it's sort of a location-based kind of, you've already got a location-based kind of game under your belt, which is pretty impressive. That's great.
Yeah, and that's what I think the best thing about the university is, that you get the chance to make up this project and then actually do it. And you will get supported, and you can ask advice. We have some great game design teachers and some great teachers who have media studies. We talk about media studies, which was more useful to me than I thought it would. So that's what I really enjoyed. And then throughout, we found our little group of four people. We did a game jam together outside of university, where we just, it was a Ludum Dare, I think 35, the 35th Ludum Dare game jam. It was a weekend. We did, in 2 days, we did a little game where you had to, basically the topic was shapeshift. And we did a. We wanted to make a game where everyone could work their ass off, because we have different skill sets, and I hate game jams where one person has to do a lot of more work than the other.
Right, which is every jam.
Yeah, it's terrible.
whether it's animation or games or what have you.
So we wanted to design a game around avoiding that, and that's how Vectronome kind of started to, like, that's when it was born. Basically, we have a musician who studied music in Colombia. He's a really cool guy, Juan Orjuela. We had I was there, my friend Balint, who's also from Hungary. We came here together to study together, and he's also a game designer. And my background is in level design, and I love level design, so I always feel like I would like to do a lot of level design. So the programmer said that he's going to do the simplest level editor we can do, which was setting up a grid in Unity and pulling in cube prefabs. So that's why the whole game is set in this orthographic grid-based thing. So because we just whipped a level editor together where you pull in prefabs and kind of specify the behavior of the individual squares. And originally we had a game where you press the shift key and the whole level layout changes, and it's a puzzle game where you cycle through level layouts and kind of, okay, there's a path on this cycle, but it blocks you in this cycle, so you have to move here before you cycle, like stuff like that. It was a really puzzly puzzle game. And then we made it so, because our musician made a lot of music, we just thought, well, let's, instead of you having the shift key, we just map the shift key to an on-beat action. So it's like a one line of code thing where instead it cycles every beat now, a different level layout. And then we kind of had this system where basically it was stop motion animation, but with rhythm. So every beat was one frame. Mm-hmm. And that's how basically Vectronome works.
Yeah, it's pretty, you made some pretty insidious levels for that game. And it gets difficult pretty quickly. But yeah, now that you're saying how you built it, it makes so much sense. Like, oh yeah, it's like, I can see you creating these things and then just having ideas just flow from there. Because even though you think it's limited, you know, that palette that you have, and the you know, the along with the music, the variety and the levels that you have. How many levels are there, by the way?
31. 30, and the 31st one is like a special boss level with a special mechanic in it. Mm-hmm. In retrospect, I feel like we could have done more. But I'm also very happy with the scope of the game. I think it's it's really difficult to get a game to feel like a thing. It's usually open a friend's Unity project or a game someone made, and it feels just like it feels like somebody's student project. It doesn't feel like a video game. It's somehow the pacing is wrong. Something is essentially completely screwed on such a deep level that you cannot express it. And with this game, I feel like it feels like a unit. At the end, you feel like you finished something, and all the ideas that were brought up, all the little puzzles that were brought up had some sort of conclusion. We definitely have more ideas, but for that, we would have needed more time, and then development ran short, so we had to finish it, and yeah.
So now, so this came basically sprung out of a game jam. How did you make the transition into just making it a product? Was it just a Steam thing and you're like, hey, let's pay the fee and just do it, whatever? Or did a publisher contact you, or how did that come into play?
Yeah, it took us 3 years to get from the game jam to now. So it was a really arduous road. But originally, while we were in the university, we have a economics professor who was high up at Blue Byte in Düsseldorf, which is part of Ubisoft now. And she did an incubator for young professionals to start a company and have a product and kind of find a publisher. So not necessarily find a publisher, find investment, find a way to make the company work. And we thought, well, let's apply to this. And we kind of got it. Like, there was a competition, many groups can apply, and we were the one who ended up being chosen from those groups. And this was still within the frame of the university, but it was no longer part of the university. So it was one of our professors who does this on the side. And then we were on the road to found a company. Arte was part of this whole incubator deal. Arte France, who is our publisher now, but we didn't know that back then. And they gave us a little bit of money to develop the idea, which meant, and then we got also a little office in the ground floor of the university as part of the incubator from the university, where they give office space for, entrepreneurs. So people who want to found their company and make a project or something like that. And we lived there for a long time, and started to build the thing. We applied for every single festival on Earth, every game show, everything. There's so many resources for indies to show their games. And in the beginning, I think the game kind of sucked because we had a really harsh philosophy. I think it was more punky. It was more fuck you. This is a hard game. Deal with it.
It's like the Dark Soul of rhythms, Dark Souls of rhythm games, right?
In a way, but there's many ways a game can feel. Like, even with Dark Souls, I feel like there's a tough but fair kind of vibe to it.
Right, right.
And it's so systematic that if you pay attention to the design, I never played Dark Souls, but I know, have a lot of friends who did and can't shut up about it. But if you pay attention to the animation and the way the designer's mind works, then you can slowly predict everything and kind of do things that look impossible. And I think that's where we ended up being. But we lost a lot of that punky attitude because of that from the beginning. And we had to find the core of a game. We didn't actually make compose music for individual levels in the beginning. I think there's an old version of the game that's still playable somewhere on the internet. Basically, we just had matched the BPM of a generic track. And then we slowly realized that there are musical patterns, basically. And if you match the musical pattern with the gameplay pattern that's happening on the screen, then the game feels amazing. And that's the game. And that's what we're looking for. So we had to make up a level design pipeline for that, where we talk to a musician and go back and forth between music and gameplay.
Nice, nice. I mean, and it shows. I mean, I wouldn't have thought 3 years for the project, but since it's a first time project, but it is so clean. It's such a striking game, even though it's simple polygons. The color palette you guys chose, and just this, like you said before, the scope of the game, it just feels so solid. So for a first time release, it's pretty astounding.
Yeah, thank you. I think getting there, like the 3 year, we could do this game. Obviously, we could do this game because we will remember how we did it. But if we would have to do a similarly scoped game now, it would take us a year. We had to found a company and become adults. Mm-hmm. I think that was the biggest deal. And also now I look for the core of the gameplay. Like, what's the gameplay loop? I think in the beginning I didn't recognize how weak the concept was without actually matching the music or like going deeper with the level design and seeing what this is actually about. And now, as a professional, I would look for that and I would try to find that in the game before I embark on making a million levels, because I think that's very important. To usually you build yourself into a corner and then you get to attach to stuff you made before and then you cannot cut it anymore. And cutting is really important. So we cut a lot of stuff for Vectronom. We had a lot of things which kind of worked but didn't completely. So that's why it also feels polished, because everything that's in there, with the exception of two levels that I really don't like, I think it's solid. At least to the outside eye, it feels solid. And I'm very happy about that. In Rectronom, there are some very experimental features. There's a click mode, which means that the game can, instead of outputting music, is outputting a click that you can connect to a drum machine. And if you have that gear, if you have a synthesizer, a drum machine, anything at home, you can connect your game to it and make your own music while your friends play. So, and then you have a whole other level of game, because you have to help your friends succeed by putting the dominant beats in the right spots and kind of doing your concert thing while it's really amazing when it's done. And it's in the game. You can do it right now. You can also connect MIDI instruments to the game and change things like that. So the colors of the game can be controlled with a MIDI instrument. If you have a launch pad with these buttons that you can hammer down on, usually it's used for sampling, you can just change the color palettes and make the whole screen really react to what you're doing. And you can do that to the music, so it kind of looks amazing. You can fade between colors. And then there's another level of interaction there that you can have where, okay, I don't really like playing the game, but I want to take part. Then you can set up this thing and people can play like that. And that's why we really wanted to design the game around, to enable people to play it rather than be harsh. So you said once that you were shy about rhythm games. And I think rhythm games do that to a lot of people because, I don't have a sense of rhythm. I cannot sing. I cannot do music. And that's how most people feel. So we wanted to make a game which cuts out all the harshness of video games so you can just be comfortable doing this musical play back and forth. So we don't punish if you die. We don't punish many aspects that we could, because we want you just to feel comfortable. So that's actually the goal, to be in a flow state and not really have to think about failing or anything like that.
I wish every developer was the same, had the same thing, because I play games for fun. You know, I don't want to be challenged. Honestly, I'm challenged enough just walking down the street. So one thing I was going to ask you is that you obviously learned a tremendous amount in the 3 year time, and now you can certainly move faster, as you said. But as a level designer, what did you learn as a level designer? Because you were talking about almost the purest form of level design in Vectronom. And so it sounds like it's very iterative and you moved it around everything. It's more at the animation and all that stuff. Talk about what you learned during the process, because that's so stripped down to the core of level design.
Yeah, it's a good question. It's what I'm actually really excited about, because I'm thinking of myself more as a game designer. And then level design is something I like to do as a sub aspect of that. I think that parts, the biggest thing I had to learn to do this is time signatures and music and understand how music works. Basically, the way we do the levels is we start with a click track. So I listen to only just tack, 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 like just a click, basically.
And basically water torture
yeah.
all day long.
And I am imagining things. So I'm doing a lot of sketching on paper. And I think if you're if for any level design, sketching on paper is essential. Because you should always go into the editor with a plan. At least that's how I do it. Other people might be different. If I know that I do something which will make sense musically later on, then I can give it to the musician and he will have a much easier time doing it, first of all, and also the result will be much better. So we play a lot with time signatures in the game. So 4-4 is a regular Western musical time signature. 1-2-3-4, 1-2-3-4. And for those, you basically can imagine shapes that you can traverse in a certain amount of beats. And then if you put the dominant beat on the fourth, then let's say there's an important jump you'll have to make. Imagine you put down Tetris blocks and in this grid, and you have to jump from one Tetris block to another, and I show each block for four beats. Then everything would kind of fit. So that's maybe it's difficult because it's so abstract to explain this.
Yeah.
But what I'm basically have to pay attention to is when is the player where? So on which beat are we right now? And where is the player? And where could the player go? Because it's much more fun when things are branching out. There are certain things I found to be really fun that I kind of found by playing around with the system and say, I want to have this experience for the player. And that's general level design stuff. You have a goal. I want to have this gameplay encounter or whatever. And then you want to design for that. And so one of that is, for example, people in Vectronom try to map out their path and kind of follow it and make it into a linear game. And one of the fun things about Vectronom is that it's not a linear game. It's a non-linear rhythm game. And most rhythm games are runners. And they, like if you play Guitar Hero, there's only one way to succeed. Really, you have to press this button at the right time, and it's a binary fail state. So it's you either get it or you don't. And in our game, you can navigate. So there's a navigational aspect. You can step in the wrong direction and still survive, for example, but you just kind of went in a more inefficient path. And what I really want is the player to feel in a constantly a reactive be in a reactive state instead of a cerebral planning state, because it's all about flow and feeling the music. And it's hard to feel the music when you're trying to really look with your eyes and remember where to turn right and left.
To me, there's like a feeling curve that you have to get a feel for this game. It's not so much a learning curve.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
But that's a good, it is a good explanation because you're working on so many different levels. And again, it's just so simple to look at. It's deceptive. But I think you've accomplished something really special with this thing. It's pretty amazing.
Thank you. It was really fun. I also noticed that if you make an abstract game, which is super simple, you're really exposed design-wise. So everything will be questioned, every little square and cube and whatever. You can't really just whip it out and have fun with it and kind of hide your mistakes because everything is so exposed and on the screen. So that's why there was a lot of iterations on every level where the length had to be just the right amount. I'm trying to quote shapes from the previous stages. Every level has three stages, which was a completely arbitrary decision. It just, but it's kind of a beginning, middle, and end. So it has this song structure because the stages, the songs, changes from stage to stage, but it's an evolution of the song. So it's kind of you can start with a theme, go somewhere else, then return to the initial theme and stuff like that, which people respond to really innately. And then if you match that musical thing with the gameplay, for example, if you return to the same theme that you had in the beginning, That kind, those aspects make the game really feel polished, but you couldn't explain it. It's just there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the there's also part of the polish there too, is all the little tiny details in it. So the animation, the squish, and the ball squish animation of right. the actual cube, that kind of stuff, and the little idle animations where he's spinning around. Even the power-ups, isn't there some kind of movement in the little power-ups as well? There's some kind of, I mean, no, the color shift for sure.
Yeah, they're animated. The spikes are animated, the player and the power and the pickups, yeah, the power-ups. We basically didn't use any animation for a very long time. And we have a colleague who we worked with on another project previously. Well, I didn't, but some of my other co-workers did, and she's a really amazing animator and modeler and artist. So she's a 3D artist who does stuff for, well, AAA looking high poly characters, and that's mm-hmm. what she does. And then we asked her to because that's the good thing, if you have funding you can pay your friends, because she does this for a living now, that okay, could we do this for 2 weeks, you come and you just do animations for us. And she did the player, for example, the player squish. And that was really extreme in the beginning. And then we toned it down. So all of her stuff, we toned down a lot to make it more... there was a sort of a trade-off. The more animation you had, the less it felt like... There's this innate problem in the game that you are moving something that takes some time to get from A to B in the world where everything changes within a frame. So everything mm-hmm. changes on the beat, and you're matching that beat, and your movement, if you press the button right on the beat, then your player starts kind of moving over. So we kind of set up the mercy periods of how, obviously moving on beat, there's a window of opportunity there. You cannot just specify a single frame to like, now is the beat. And we set it up in a way where we have some time for you to still be pressing the button on the beat and see your little player or character move. But actually, in the system's mind, you are moving with the beat.
I'm really glad you said that, because that was the thing I was curious about, is like, you don't have to get into specifics about milliseconds or things, but I think the game would be impossible if you had to hit it right on that frame. So yeah, I was wondering how that works. I'm glad you brought you covered that. That was one of my questions. I can strike that off.
We have a slider in the UI in the options, which is just making the game feel loose and making the game feel tight. So you can make it feel tighter or looser, depending on what your input is. I use, for example, this IBM Model M keyboard, which has a lot of input delay, and if I make it a little bit looser, it still feels tight for me because I just have a different setup. If you play on a television, it has to go through a cable and whatever. So also for people who just have a different sense of rhythm and they have a looser sense of rhythm, that's fine. You can set it up in a different way. You don't really know the future in Vectronome. So in other games, you can kind of account for basically you jump somewhere and something is going to appear there. Maybe in the next beat. So you jumped a little too early, but you're still within the mercy period. For various reasons, we can only extend the mercy period on both sides, when you're early or when you're too late, even though the player perceives them to be two separate situations and separate failures. So, oh, I jumped too early. Oh, I jumped too late. We try to give you more feedback by making the player texture a little thump a little. When you are actually on the beat, but no one notices that. So
I'll be looking for it next time I want to throw my controller across. I'm really bad at rhythm games, so I've been very shy about this one. But so let's talk about so next step. So now you've got a game release under your belt. I read, you know, the Sean Murray, who came out with No Man's Sky with the Hello Games, said the worst time of a game's lifespan is release. So is that something that you found? Were there highs and lows in the process?
Oh, yeah. Definitely. Lots of highs and lows. It's kind of intoxicating when you're going towards release and you're crunching, but you are sprinting. You have a release date and you're fighting for that. And every morning you wake up and you're focused. And that's an amazing feeling. I really want to make this game the best it can be for release. And then once release happens, you realize that nothing really matters. Like, it doesn't really matter. And it's actually not a sprint, but a marathon. And you have to now have an update. And now you have to promote the game. And actually, our game, nobody waited for our game. So maybe with No Man's Sky, it was a different kind of pain when it was released. Everyone was waiting for it.
That's true. That's true.
But nobody was like, yeah, Vectronome, you know. People were, because we went to so many showcases. We showcased the game in Berlin and South Africa and Boston and London. I could keep going. We had so many showcases. Really everywhere. So every time we have a showcase, there's always a crowd around it and people watching. And we have drop-in, drop-out multiplayer, so you can play with your friends. Which makes the game a little bit more forgiving, because if your friends get to the checkpoint, everybody goes along with it, and it makes the game a little easier. You feel less lonely, and you feel like you're dancing with someone, which is also cute.
Right.
But yeah, nobody was waiting for the game, and now it's out, and now we have to kind of make, instead of having a high peak and a big valley, we have to make a slow hill and a slow climb and try to find our audience. Because there is no, like, rhythm games are not the most popular genre. But also people who play rhythm games look at our game and it doesn't look like a rhythm game. It looks like a platformer. Only when upon further inspection, it looks like a rhythm game. We have a sort of problem that we can't explain the game without showing a video of it with audio.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. I didn't even think of that. Because I came into it knowing what it was.
Right.
But if you came in blind, you'd be like, oh, well, that's a weird little easy platform. Oh, wait, spikes, that kind of stuff. Interesting. So now did you have any inkling of how this was going to feel? Because the game program at Cologne is, so new. Was this something they covered? Do they cover the social aspect and the, kind of, stress that you might be under when you're making games? Is that part of the curriculum?
That's a good question. No, not really. They try to talk about how to find an audience for a game and marketing, but not about how you're going to feel from development. I was really depressed right after release. And that is a thing. My mother is a filmmaker, and when I told her, oh, mom, I feel so terrible. I don't know why. I cannot wake up in the morning. I just don't want to go anywhere. And she just said, like, yeah, that's what you get when you finish a big project. It's going to be like that for a while. And I wasn't prepared. I also wasn't, I don't know. I think I crunched too much. We crunched too much. Everybody kind of gave up on social life a little bit and burnt out. And that was not good. That makes sense. If literally the world is going to end on release and you will never talk and meet again, then fine, whatever. But now we have to make this company work and this game work and have the next game coming up. And we need excitement and energy and all these things for that. So it's not worth it to completely kill yourself over a release. Because then you cannot just keep going. So you need to be a little bit more selfish with your time and shut off somewhat.
Yeah, and that's the same as many disciplines. You know, I've experienced this in my life, and I'm not a developer, but you know, project-based work that I do, I've had the same thing where you're just crunching and going crazy. Maybe not as long as a video game, but and then yeah, when it ends, you're just like, who am I? You know, you become this project and this goal, and it's all encompassing. Because when you're doing that, like you say, you get rid of social life and you get rid of all the normal things in your life, and going back to quote unquote normal is extremely difficult. So I wonder if, you know, that might be some, if not a class, some kind of workshop or element of a class going forward. Because one of the things I wanted to talk to you about is, you know, you're an indie developer. First game out the gate, And you know that it's a numbers game. You're swinging for the fences, as we say in the United States. You're trying to hit a home run, and home runs don't happen very often, you know. And it's difficult, you know. Have you know, games like Delver and things like that, where people we know really well and we're rooting for them, and it's this long 5-year development cycle. And then did it do well? Well, I don't know. It's not a mega hit or anything, and it's just think projects like this have to just be demoralizing. So I don't want to talk about sales numbers or anything, but was it what you expected? Is it going to continue? Is the company going to continue? And what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah. So without getting into big details, we are right now trying to have it do better, because I think we imagined it to do better. I think it can do better because it's a good game. And I think once it's kind of a problem where if the reviews would be terrible or something like that, if the feedback would be that, oh yeah, the game doesn't really feel right, then we would kind of accept our and move on. But this way, I feel the response has been so good from the people who played it, but there's very few people who played it. So I imagine that if more... the people want this, they just don't know. So maybe we'll find some sort of way. We're going to do this on Gamescom is coming up in a week. And we're basically really, really crunching now for Gamescom and having a booth there and trying to get more media coverage and things like that. But that's not even the point. If we get to keep going, is we were lucky enough to be surrounded by people who support us and be in a city and in a country which supports us. This might be a difference between the US and Europe, that in Europe you have so much public fund for media. And we're not so reliant on the market to completely get us through this rut after release, because the way it works, we have a publisher and they give you money. And then the money runs out when development ends. But you don't get money from the game right after release. So you have to kind of bridge those gaps. And now we are really working on bridging that. But I feel confident that this will keep going. So we're really lucky in that regard.
Right. Yeah, that is interesting. That's a different distinction there, where it's almost like you get your seed money and they're really supportive of the... of the initial part of the project, and then you're on your own. And that there are ways to bridge those gaps, I'm sure, but doing kind of contract work, et cetera, and all that stuff. So it kind of leads me to my next question. So what would you tell people, because I'm sure there's more than a few who are listening that do want to make a living making games, and do, you know, some of them are in school for it. What would you tell people starting out?
Well, you have to kind of know what you want to do and what you are interested in, because not everything about game development will be exciting and fun and nice. So what I really love is game design and level design. And I mostly get to do pitches and emails, and that's already 70% of my time of just doing the day-to-day of the business. But if you know what you want to do, then you can kind of build your thing around that, and people will give you money if they see that you're intelligent and excited and into it. But to get there, you have to be disciplined in a way, and without being self-abusive, because I think people can also smell on you when you kind of deep down hate yourself. And you can easily get there when nothing comes together, we had a long, long period where we didn't have a publisher, and we were knocking on every door, and we sent out the game. And what got us through that period was knowing that the game is good, that you really deep down know that this game feels good to play. I show it to other people and they know that it's good. And if I wouldn't have had that, then I don't think I would have kept going. And that's not even about the money aspect of it. We kind of transition from student life, where you get a bunch of benefits for being a student, where housing is more cheap, where you're just leading a different life. You're in a different you're operating in a different level to now a world where we have our own company, we pay ourselves very modestly, but we pay ourselves. And I'm very proud of that, that we could make that happen. And then other opportunities will kind of open up. Let it be investors or publishers funding a project, or maybe just the government saying that we want more tech in our area, and if I will give you this much money if you fill out 50 pages in German, and you will spend it in North Rhine-Westphalia and whatever. So there's so many opportunities like that here. And I think also in the US, I think everybody talks about in bringing tech to their city, that there are incubators, there are co-working spaces. And if you know how to kind of approach those opportunities, then you will have an easier time making well, not making a living, but I think we're, you know, like for a long time setting up a company, you're losing money. You're continuously putting money and effort and time that you could be spending on other things into something that doesn't generate anything yet, something aspirational. And we are a really weird team. We're international. So I'm from Hungary. Two of us are from Hungary. A programmer is from Germany. Our musician is from Colombia. We have a project manager who's from Italy and an Austrian like technical artist who does shader work. And it's such a strange team of people living in Germany, and we get to be published and funded by a French cultural fund.
Wow.
Who makes television. Like, what?
That's really interesting. So what's the weirdest office story you could tell? You know, were there any kind of miscommunications or cultural issues?
It's fun. We were friends before, and I think we transitioned into like working companions as well. So you have different etiquettes, but we spent a lot of time here. We have parties here. We have a stream. It used to be weekly. We cannot keep the weekly, but we want to do it more often. And we kind of do little parties where we jam. So we have a bunch of music. It's filled with synthesizers, one of the rooms, and with drum machines and all that stuff. And we make music, and in the other room, we do something else. So it's a really fun office to be around. I get to be sometimes hold my head like, holy shit, I get to do this for a living. I get to come in here every day and then also have a space to hang out in with my friends. I also, about these streams, once we did a level design stream, and that should be on Twitch, if anybody's more interested in how the level design process of Vectronome works. That's an interesting... I talked for 2 hours about, and I made some levels live, so you can see the whole process kind of.
So when you were younger, you had LAN parties, and you know that's such an integral part of the Quake scene and and games that are inspired by Quake. Tell me about your experiences. What was a LAN party like for you growing up?
Right. So I had the biggest apartment from my group of friends who were very nerdy people. And basically, I used to be the one who hosted these events. I wasn't really growing up in the time of LAN parties, but PCs were more popular, I think, than consoles in Eastern Europe in general. More people had PCs. Nobody had gaming consoles. And usually, the social video game experience that people have here in Germany is I went to my friend's place and we played the Nintendo 64, I don't know, GoldenEye. But for me, I wanted, for us, it was more about bringing your computers and putting them together and having an actual LAN party. And these could go on for days. So the way we planned it is, okay, we're going to clear out a weekend or a long weekend or something like that and have everyone over. And there was a core group of people who came and then people who just came by and did stuff. So, for example, I have a friend who's in the competitive Team Fortress community in Hungary. He's a really, really, really high level player. And he played in a competition once and he went home to play. But we had everyone there from the Hungarian community, Team Fortress community, to commentate on the match. So they set up a little booth thing with a microphone, and they were commentating the match live, which my friend was playing from two rooms over. It was very, it was kind of like these experiences where you get to feel like you're part of a community mm-hmm. because everybody's around, and you get to look at each other's stuff, and you get to play the games that you don't get to usually play in this context. It was mostly Team Fortress and Counter-Strike, but we kind of, they had these little experiences like playing Proteus. You never get to play Proteus unless it's a big LAN party. I don't know if you're familiar with that game. It's basically Star Trek. You each control a different aspect of a spaceship, and it's very basic UI. It's just pushing buttons, but there's a commander who only sees inputs, and they shout to the other one, well, we need more power on the shields. We need this, we need that. And there's one shield guy, there's one weapons guy. It was amazing.
And does the engineer have to have a Scottish accent? I don't have enough power, Captain.
Yeah, there should be a power-up where you, out of nowhere, get more, like, just find more power.
Right, that's awesome. That sounds like a lot of fun, too. Yeah. Well, okay, well, let me switch gears here with the LAN parties. So did you ever play Quake 3 at LAN parties?
No. I had friends who played Quake. I personally wasn't into the Quake. Now I'm playing insane amount of, again, just 1v1 Quake. Mm-hmm. I cannot go online and play against other people because they beat me terribly.
Yeah, me too. me too.
I do it, and sometimes I find people, but it's very difficult to find people you can reliably play against unless you know them. And we have a really good dynamic with my friend. But that, for me, Quake is really that. And I know that Quake is so many other things. It's team deathmatch is so different. And there's the whole aspect of the offline, the single-player experiences. And I was always around that world. I used to play a lot of Half-Life 2 mods, like single-player mods, mm-hmm. where it's also about you go into this world and you kind of see, okay, what did this guy do? What is it about? Are we, it's a, I don't know, saw blade puzzle thing, and it's all about saw blades, and then you move on to the next thing, which is some other person's little vision of a world. And with now I try to play more Quake 1 single player mod. Well, they're not mods, they're just maps. That's what I love about it. You have to set up anything. And it's always this very strong vision from someone, like, I see how your mind works, and I really appreciate that as a game designer. It's somehow really pure, and I miss that in a lot of other games. It's interesting, the originally, I think I said my mother is a filmmaker, and she, in the early 2000s, there was a big move towards interactive media and transmedia for the people from the film world. And she had a lot of concepts and ideas. And actually, for a brief period, she talked to the guy who made Myst and Riven. And they had a project together that they were trying to get going, but it never happen. But she did a lot of research in video games to basically get to know this world. And then she moved on and did movies and never really did anything interactive. But that was my first experience with video games, is everything she played. And she bought some really artsy, high concept, these interactive CDs from the early 2000s, late 90s. Peter Gabriel's Eve. Peter Gabriel made an interactive CD called Eve, which is about one of his albums. And it's a beautiful point-and-click adventure. And I played that when I was very little. It was my first video game, and it's mind-blowing how beautiful it is. I didn't understand any English. There were some like voice memos from people describing sex. Like, it was artsy-fartsy stuff, but I didn't get most of it. For me, it was just, wow, this is like being inside a dream. And it immediately entranced me. And another game that she bought was Half-Life 2. And she didn't want me to play Half-Life 2 because I was too little, and Ravenholm, and I'm not going to, it's too much. So she said that, well, it's Half-Life 2, you're not going to understand Half-Life 2 without playing Half-Life 1. So she got me Half-Life 1, and Half-Life 1 is still scary and stuff, but it's more simple, like it doesn't look as photorealistic. And then it took me years to finish Half-Life 1 and just finish that, and I played all the expansions, and I was really into Half-Life 1. And then I basically broke through to Half-Life 2, got into Gary's Mod, started to build stuff, was really into building stuff, eventually realized there's a level editor for Half-Life, which blew my mind because I was already trying to get stuff done in Gary's Mod that I couldn't. Like, how do you make a wall? You can only add all these props, but how do I make a wall? So that was a big breakthrough. And then I just did level design for years for anything I could get my hands on, basically. So I was downloading level editors. I bought hundreds of crappy games. Usually I went to the game store and I have some money and I could buy one AAA game, or if I could buy 10 bargain bin games, I would buy 10 bargain bin games. I would always buy anything. And I made Postal 2. I had this amazing collection of DOS games that I bought. I had some really intense memories with crappy Eastern European racing games nobody heard of. So I really expanded my palette and soak everything up. And again, that's when Masters of Doom came along, and I sort of started reading that you could, how could it feel to make games and all those experiences that come with it. And I was really, really sold on making games, basically. So that's kind of how I got into the entirety of video gaming. And that's the strange part, that Quake itself was always there in other games, like Half-Life 1, for example. It feels very much similar, even though it is a completely different paced experience. Now that I play Quake live, I feel like strong nostalgia for it, even though I never played Quake before. And that's due to the mood of the game as well, that it's not a story. It's not like a story that you cannot relate to, but a mood. And a lot of older games had this dark mood just kind of carried over from Quake. I did write my bachelor thesis about movement in first-person games. So it was a lot of Quake in there. Basically, the point of the thesis was that how does it feel to navigate 3D space differently? And that is kind of... a lot of times people go into making games and just try to emulate real life, especially if it's 3D, especially if it's first-person. And it's not. It's always an abstraction. And Quake is, for example, the reason they left strafe jumping so organically in the game is because it makes sense within the constraints. It wasn't just trying to make it feel like real life, but they did this world where you can move around and you have these variables, and they made what made most sense for the game and not what made most sense for a story or something. And I really appreciate that about the game.
So, hey, George, thank you so much for being on the Quakecast. It's been a real pleasure. Definitely a different episode, but I think you have a lot to say, and I'm very excited for the future of your company and your exploits in Hungary.
Thank you. I'm really glad that this happened. This might as well not happen. It's so random. I wrote on RC's video that I'm really happy. I just started to listen to you guys because I got into Quake Live, and it was such a surprise, really, that this happened. I'm so happy.
This is RC. Thanks for listening to the Quakecast. You can find me on YouTube at youtube.com/watchGGRC.
And I'm Dump Truck. You can find me on YouTube. Just search for Dump Truck _DS.